Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Finley, who is a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Finley.
Thank you so much, Ian. You have a Brookings theme today.
Well, it's an accident, but a welcome one. So the presidents have often said that we can't allow the world's most dangerous weapons ending up in the hands of the world's most dangerous people. Well, of course, that's a little bit like water under the bridge if you consider Assad dangerous. Certainly a lot of his people do. But now, of course, Vladimir Putin is saying it's the rebels who fired the rocket full of sarin, or the rockets full of sarin. So what's your sense then of how, assuming this deal goes through, how's it going to be executed? How do you get rid of one of the world's largest chemical arsenals in the midst of a civil war?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ian, and it really is obviously an incredibly complicated and time-consuming and also expensive process, and also potentially dangerous on a number of fronts, not only for those who will be ultimately executing the destruction process, but for those citizens that live in and around the multiple storage sites that exist in Syria and ultimately which will become ultimately destruction sites. So there are obviously multiple challenges that we can certainly get into. The broad steps behind how this should ostensibly take place, and we have word, of course, today that the Assad regime has acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention. That itself is a time-consuming process. He has essentially submitted the instruments of accession. They will be ultimately deposited at the OPCW. It'll be a 30-day process, and then 30 days later, they will become a member. So, we're not quite even yet at the point where we have, the political capacity to begin executing on a destruction plan. Then we have a very complicated process that is launched from that point on. The first stage is essentially for the government in Syria to undertake a comprehensive examination of the full stockpile. That includes not just their chemical munitions, but also vast quantities of agents that we suspect that they have, an accounting of their production facilities, of their research facilities. There are five production facilities, we believe. We don't know that for sure. Then we'll move to a point where all that information will be shipped to The Hague, the headquarters of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It will be verified by the OPCW, and then we will move to actual the destruction phase of this. So this is a months-long process before we even begin to destroy the first chemical munition.
And of course, Secretary of State Kerry has already said it's unacceptable. I mean, he doesn't want to wait for 30 days, for example, for the certification. He wants to move ahead more quickly than that. So is it possible to do this with the Russian and the Americans under the UN umbrella and get those people in sooner?
It absolutely is. Of course, that in and of itself requires the political agreement of the Assad regime. It requires an environment in which these inspectors can go in a safe environment and undertake their activities. That obviously does not currently exist on the ground in Syria at the moment. We also have no sense as to what state their chemical stockpile is in. If the stockpile that the Russians held, the United States and other countries helped disassemble in the immediate wake of the Cold War, is any indication, it is possible that these chemical munitions that the Assad government has are some in very good shape that are obviously weapons usable and have obviously been used on the outskirts of Damascus in late August. Others, however, we don't know what the state is. They could well be rotting in warehouses and could be extremely volatile. So there are a number of political complications that gets us to the point of destruction, and then there are clear technical complications as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Finley, who's a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. Now, there are a couple of precedents of getting rid of a chemical arsenal. One under the United Nations, the so-called UNSCOM regime. I just spoke before we went on the air with an UNSCOM weapons inspector who explained how they destroyed the stockpiles in Iraq, where they did it on site. That is obviously the only way to do it, right? But then, so what, but the other example, of course, is Libya. Now, Gaddafi had agreed when he had his road to Damascus conversion and then gave up his nuclear program and exposed his chemical program as well. And a lot of that actually led to the AQ Khan network. But that was not complete, was it, by the time the Syrian revolution took place and then the NATO intervention?
No, you're absolutely right, Ian. So it was December, as you recall, of 2003 when Gaddafi had his conversion. He agreed to begin surrendering his stockpiles of chemical weapons, as well as obviously came clean on his nuclear program. Activities got underway. Again, it took a long time to actually get the process up and running. The program did start destruction on site in Libya. It was interrupted by the Arab Spring in early 2011. It was resumed in late 2011 by the interim government. Then a technical malfunction essentially halted the destruction program. And now 9 years later, we're still working in Libya to destroy that chemical stockpile. And that was for a chemical stockpile, bear in mind, Ian, that was around 25 metric tons. If intelligence estimates are correct, in Syria, we're talking about a chemical stockpile of close to 1,000 metric tons of chemical agents. So orders of magnitude larger, orders of magnitude more time-consuming, orders of magnitude less safe in the environment that we were even dealing with in Libya, and orders of magnitude obviously more costly.
But just to compare this, just to give an idea how difficult this process is, let's look at the United States example. The United States has this, after the Soviet Union, has the world's second largest chemical weapons stockpile. 16 years ago, it joined the convention banning chemical weapons. Am I right on that date? I mean, it actually joined earlier, but I think the implementation was about 16 years ago.
Exactly. The entry into force was in 1997.
Right. So then they started to destroy these weapons. And then what they found was that they had, five sites. And because of local political pressure, nobody and various congressional districts and interests weighing in, they didn't want to transport all of these chemical weapons to the one site where they could have been destroyed. So they had to make, four other destruction sites, which added enormously to the costs and delayed it, right? And at this point, 16 years later, my understanding is they've only destroyed, well, they have destroyed up to about 80%. Is that right?
That's correct, Ian. So we started back in 1997 with a declared stockpile of around just over 31,000 tons of chemical agent. You're quite correct in your characterization of some of the political challenges. There were also some technical challenges as well that related to the political. So in order to destroy this stuff, there are essentially two different methods that one might pursue. Early on in the U.S. program, the United States government decided on the first method, which is an incineration method, which is essentially bringing the chemical munitions in, draining the liquid, feeding the liquid into a liquid incinerator, and burning it at 2,700 degrees. The munitions are then burned in a metal furnace, and the ash is disposed of as hazardous waste. there was a growing movement across the United States early on in the destruction program that this was seen by local residents as unsafe. And so beyond the immediate political calculus in terms of not in my backyard, there was also a decision at some point, driven by political calculations, to move to the second pathway for destruction, which is a neutralization process, a hydrolysis process, which is essentially the chemical agent is drained. It's essentially diluted with hot water and sodium hydroxide. It's treated then as hazardous waste. It's stored in large casks and ultimately finds its way into deep repository. You're quite correct to say there was a not in my backyard attitude which certainly delayed the program, which led to the a ballooning price tag. And bear in mind, in 1997, we estimated that the price tag of destroying those 31,000 tons of chemical ammunition would be about $2 billion, and today we're looking at a price tag of about $35 billion. And so those, as I say, local challenges also really led to additional delays in terms of when we've got to build, we've got to change modalities in terms of how we destroy this agent, and we need to actually build facilities now to manage that process.
And we should all be a defense contractor, right? And be beneficiaries of those kind of cost overruns. So Brian Finley, back to the Syrian arsenal. My understanding is, and that you've written about this, where you've made reference to the AQ Khan network, which brought about Pakistan's secret nuclear weapons program, and which is now one of the most vigorous, at least the fastest growing in the world. And then, of course, the proliferation to Iran, North Korea, and Libya, and a lot of it was uncovered when Gaddafi gave up his program. He operated AQ Khan through getting a lot of Western companies in the U.S., the Netherlands, Britain, Germany, Switzerland, etc., to cooperate with him. Maybe some of them may not have known what they were doing, but some of them may well have known what they were doing. I understand that the Assads have been basically up to the same thing, that they've been relying on a lot of Western countries, including, I believe, a company in Maine here in the United States, to get some of their precursors for the sarin, the very gas that was used on August the 21st.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it points to a much broader problem in truth, Ian, and it's one that is extremely distressing for security analysts and should be distressing for all of us. So you alluded quite rightly to the parallels between the AQ Khan network, AQ Khan being the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, really a hero in that country in terms of the first country, Islamic country, to cross the threshold and obtain a nuclear weapon. He operated a side business, though he was officially employed by the Pakistani government in aid of that nuclear program. He, as I say, ran a side business that essentially marketed sensitive nuclear knowledge and nuclear materials necessary to build nuclear weapons to a wide variety of countries, unbeknownst to us in the West and the wider international community for over a decade. That ultimately helped contribute to North Korea's nuclear program, to the Libyan nuclear program. We know he had contacts with Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi nuclear program, and we suspect as well, and there's some evidence to suggest that he also had links with al-Qaeda and their interest in pursuing a nuclear weapon capability for terrorist use. The network that he employed was so vast and so shockingly sophisticated in two ways. One, by its sheer size, but two, by the fact that he operated it for so long unbeknownst to the international community. And this, in many ways, is also the story of the Assad regime in support of his chemical weapons. So, as you know, he developed a program, Assad, his chemical weapons program, in counterbalance to the Iraqi nuclear program. This is now in the 1980s, and essentially was aided, certainly, as Secretary Hagel has mentioned in his hearing, in his testimony on Capitol Hill a week or so ago, was certainly aided by the Russian government and other allied governments of the Syrian regime. But what is becoming increasingly apparent is it is not just the Russian government and the North Koreans that aided that program, but, as you pointed out, similar to the AQCON network, he managed to tap an international black market of chemical providers, and not just in those countries, but, as you also point out, in the Netherlands, here in the United States, in the United Kingdom. The inherent challenge in these technologies, similar to nuclear technologies, the inherent challenge with chemical technologies is that they are in many cases dual use, that they can be used produce fertilizers, to produce agents to build aluminum frames for windows, to make cosmetics, to a whole range of very legitimate commercial uses. But on the other hand, they can be also used to and diverted for nefarious purposes, and that is obviously what Bashar Assad has done over the course of a couple of decades in building what was and perhaps still is the world's third largest chemical weapons stockpile.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Brian Finley, but I guess just in closing, we obviously it's better to have this deal go through than not go through, but it's I guess the we can agree that it's a long way from being done, and it's going to take a lot longer. And I don't know how the U.S. is going to keep the threat of military force alive over that long period. But we'll wait and see, I guess.
Indeed, and it certainly is a problem, unfortunately, in that extends beyond beyond Syria as well. And if the administration really is serious about controlling chemical weapons, there is much more that needs to be done in terms of breaking up these black market networks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Brian Finley.
Thank you.
Again, Brian Finley is a chemical weapons expert and senior associate at the Stimson Center, where he directs the center's Managing Across Boundaries initiative. Previously, he was a senior researcher at the Brookings Institution and a program officer at the Century Foundation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with an alternative scenario about what is behind all the turmoil in the Middle East.